The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here with a special plea. No, it's not for money, although if you want to donate to Lawfare, I certainly don't want to discourage that, and that donate button on the site is always there for you. Really, we put it there just for you. No, but today I want to talk about the fact that we only have 22 ratings on iTunes. Now, to be sure, they are really good ratings. And if you're one of those 22 people who left those ratings, I thank you. But if you're not, I want you to take a minute and go rate the Lawfare podcast on iTunes, or if you're a Stitcher user, rate us on Stitcher. The Lawfare podcast doesn't advertise. The only way we have of getting the word out about the podcast is things like ratings and social media shares, tweets, Facebook shares, that sort of thing. In other words, we really depend on you. So take a moment and do your part. There are a lot of people in the world who have never heard of the Lawfare podcast. You can help solve this problem. Thanks.
As many of you know, last December, a couple days before Christmas in the dead of winter, there was the first cyber attack, a destructive attack on critical infrastructure upon which civilian populations depend. Was an attack on the electric grid in Ukraine. It brought down the power for 250,000 people. We were invited by Ukraine to come over as part of an interagency team to help them, again, to figure out what had happened here, to make sure that the bad actors were off their system, and to help them think about how to rebuild more securely. The bad news, obviously, is that we saw this first destructive attack, and it had a pretty significant impact. The good news is it was not a particularly sophisticated attack, and we know how to prevent what happened in Ukraine.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 11th, 2016. That's the voice of Suzanne Spaulding, Undersecretary for the National Protection and Programs Directorate at the Department of Homeland Security. Spaulding and I sat down in front of a live audience at a DHS cyber conference this week to discuss the agency's role in cyber defense and cybersecurity. It's a wide-ranging conversation dealing with DHS's role both in protecting private sector infrastructure and in defending unclassified government systems. We talked about standing up DHS capability in cyber, we talked about Ukraine, and we took questions from the audience. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 174, Suzanne Spaulding on Cyber.
So I'd like to start with just DHS's role in cybersecurity. When people think of the federal government and cybersecurity, they think of, the FBI, they think of NSA, the nerds will think of NIST, and then there's you guys. And I want you to start, if you could, by describing the niche and describing the authorities and responsibilities behind the niche.
Well, Ben, I really appreciate the question, because you're right. Not a lot of people understand what DHS's role is in cybersecurity. And I think in part that's because A big part of what we do is to work with private sector companies, both before, during, and after an incident. But when we do that at their invitation, we don't then go in front of TV cameras or microphones to talk about it. One of the coins of the realm for us, a key element that allows us to do our mission, is to maintain that trust with the private sector and with other departments and agencies as well. And so we don't trumpet the work that we do. And I think in part that that is why folks don't have a full appreciation for the role that we play. But it is a very important role. So fundamentally, we lead the effort to protect the civilian government systems, the .gov space. And each department and agency is ultimately responsible for their own cybersecurity. But we provide a baseline. So we provide, make sure that departments and agencies know what the best practices are. We have a baseline suite of tools and technologies that we provide to all departments and agencies that provide them with with some basic layered defense technologies. So we have Einstein, which is our intrusion detection and prevention protection technology that looks at the perimeter. And then we have our continuous diagnostics and mitigation tools, which are really private sector innovations, private sector tools that we provide to departments and agencies to help them police inside their networks and understand what their configurations are, and in subsequent phases, who's on their network and what they're doing on their network. So that kind of baseline for the government. And then we do play a leading role in coordinating activities to protect the non-governmental entities in cyber, working in conjunction with our colleagues in other departments and agencies, and most importantly, working very closely with the private sector. And again, it is threat awareness, situational awareness, sharing information, understanding vulnerabilities. So we have a series of tools and capabilities to help them understand their vulnerabilities. Analytic work that we do in conjunction with our private sector partners to understand consequences, including interdependencies and cascading consequences. And then, of course, mitigation measures. What can you do to mitigate risk across all of those threat, vulnerability, and consequence?
So I want to get this out there right at the outset. There is a perception that I'm sure you're aware of and that you fight with all the time, that in the federal government there are the sort of the big kids at NSA, and then there's the sort of domestic authority people who don't have the same degree of capability. I'm interested in to what extent, in your judgment, that perception is untrue, to what extent it's true and it's a subject that the department has done work on and needs to do work on, and to what extent it's a real problem.
So, Ben, I think that perception is, at best, dated. I can't speak to the time before I came on board and Andy Osmond and Dr. Phyllis Schneck, but I can tell you that we believe that we work today with the best and the brightest in cybersecurity, with tremendous capabilities. And you and I are having this conversation at the end of a day-long conference on cybersecurity that was put together by Department of Homeland Security's Office of General Counsel. And just before we spoke, the audience got a demonstration from our technical team, our red team, showing them how we go in to departments and agencies systems or private sector systems to try to find vulnerabilities and detect problems in their systems and then come back and help them understand how to mitigate those and rebuild. And I will tell you that the work that we do, both with departments and agencies and across the country with critical infrastructure owners and operators, I get emails all the time talking about what outstanding professionals and the incredible capabilities that they've brought to bear to assist. So I think it is not a fair perception to the extent that it's out there. But I will say my sense is that more and more people understand the capabilities. And Congress has reflected that in the legislation that they've enacted over the last couple of years to really solidify DHS's role in cyber. Congress had an awful lot of skeptics, as you know, and I think their willingness to give, to make, for example, DHS the portal for sharing cyber threat indicators with the private sector reflects their confidence in our competence.
Let's break down, you mentioned sort of two broad areas of responsibility, the private sector interface and the federal civilian interface. Let's break down when a company has an incident and it calls the FBI. I kind of know what happens, right? The FBI is an investigative agency. We see the results of that sometimes in public. But when they call you guys, help me out. What happens? What does DHS go in and do?
So if we're invited in and a call to our ops center, the NCIC, the National Cybersecurity Communications Integration Center, usually means that they're looking for help and they'll invite us in. And so we will send our computer emergency response team in to work with them to, as I say, to figure out what's going on their system. So let's go in and see if we can detect malicious activity, try to look at how that might have gotten in, where it's been, what kinds of activities they may have undertaken, has there been data exfiltrated, et cetera. And then how do we get them out? We work with them to say, okay, here's how you're gonna get these guys off your system. And now we're gonna work with you to develop a mitigation plan going forward so that you can make your systems more secure going forward in the future.
And just to be clear, so what's the difference between the service that somebody would get from DHS and the service that they would, pay gazillions of dollars for from a cybersecurity firm?
And we often go in with, we're not always the only people coming in. So it's not at all unusual that a private sector company that calls us will have also called a private sector company that offers cybersecurity response capabilities or cybersecurity solutions. We also often will go in with interagency partners. So one of the things that will happen when a call comes into the NCIC is that, we will call the FBI. And so there are concurrent activities underway. So it's not an either or. And we always make it very clear, we're not interested in competing with the private sector. But we are interested in understanding the threat environment out there, both in the private sector and in the government. And so there are certainly advantages to us to being invited in so that we can, again, get a sense of what's happening in the private sector. And we can bring to bear the knowledge gleaned not just from the private sector voluntary information sharing, but also from what's happening on the .gov. And that's a unique insight and capability that we can bring that at the moment private sector companies don't have, particularly with respect to classified information.
So let's talk about the .gov. There are hundreds of incidents in federal systems all the time. Most of them are not on the classified or national security systems, so they're sort of in your bailiwick. What's the mechanism by which you guys get involved and what then do you do?
So very much the same set of activities. So if a department or agency calls and says they're seeing unusual activity or malicious activity or they know they have an intrusion, whatever stage along that awareness spectrum they might be, and ask us to come in and help, we do much the same activities there as we would in the private sector. So again, we will work with them to figure out what's going on in their system, how to get the bad guys off, how to address the vulnerabilities that allowed this intrusion activity and to rebuild in a more safe and secure manner.
But in the federal system, you presumably have more ongoing involvement, right? Because you have a sort of ongoing responsibility to protect, including at the design and implementation level of a lot of these systems. And so, what's the division of labor between you guys as a sort of incident response and best practices promulgator, right, and the people inside the relevant agencies who have the line responsibility to manage systems and protect them.
So you're absolutely right. And so, again, we not only, one of the key differences in our interaction with departments and agencies as opposed to our interaction with the private sector is that we are sitting on those .gov networks. By virtue of this intrusion detection and prevention system, which we call Einstein. And so we are able to get all of that data and see the activity that's taking place across departments and agencies. So one of the things we're able to do as a result of that is to alert departments and agencies, first of all, but also to go back and see, once we have identified malicious activity in one department or agency, go back and see where we might see that in other departments and agencies. And that's really how we detected the malicious activity at the Department of Interior, and where it turned out a lot of sensitive government information, including information about clearances, was being stored. It wasn't just at OPM. What we saw in the OPM breach, what we learned there, allowed us to put together a signature and go back and look then at the data that Einstein collects about what's going on in departments and agencies to say, where have we seen this signature anywhere else? And lo and behold, we saw that it was there at the Department of the Interior. So that's the kind of data analytics and dashboards, if you will, that we can do with the .gov that obviously we're not doing today with the private sector.
So you talked about the capability that DHS has, and I'm interested, you know, 10 years ago, DHS didn't exist, or it was just coming into existence. You've built and are 13 years ago. You've built and are building this capability. How does one, you know, start up a significant government cyber monitoring protection, and how much of that and mitigation effort, and how much of that capability at this point is organic and resident to DHS, and how much of it is, you know, sort of borrowed from other parts of the government?
So we're borrowing less and less. We have a very strong and healthy, you know, DHS workforce on cyber, but we're rapidly trying to build it, and we face the same challenges that our partners across the government and in the private sector face in trying to build and hire cyber talent. So we're working hard on building that pipeline and on trying to streamline our hiring processes. I mean, the private sector has a huge advantage over the government in being able to bring people on quickly. It's not just about how much they pay them, but they can bring them on quickly. So we're working at that. We've got some cyber incentive pay programs that we've put in place and more that are coming online. I'm trying to work a deal with the private sector where we will share the expenses of building that pipeline, and then I'll take kids right out of school and I'll give them on-the-job training for a few years at our NCIC, and then the private sector will lure them away and pay them more money for a few years, but after they've put their kids through college, they'll miss the mission and they'll come back to me.
So the FBI director has said that one of his problems in cyber is that the more he wants to hire somebody, the more likely that person is to have a security clearance problem as a result of marijuana. I'm curious whether one of the, without specific reference to marijuana, whether one of the hiring recruitment issues that you have is cultural. And, you know, there is no community sort of more countercultural than the sort of people who are often the best at cybersecurity and, you know, IT stuff in general. And I'm just interested to what extent that encumbers trying to build an entirely new workforce in the space.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Ben. And I would say it's less has less to do with getting clearances, really, and more to do with the cultural issues that you've highlighted, because, you know, even though we have tried in our op center to make it techie friendly, if you will, to try to make it an environment in which folks who are used to going on systems and doing, as Dan Sutherland described, our NCATS team doing devious things online on behalf of their government and getting paid to do it, an environment that they're more comfortable in. But it is a challenge because we are a bureaucracy, and there are rules and regulations in the federal government. And so it's something we're very mindful of. We, as I say, we've tried very hard to create the right environment. Bringing in the right kind of leadership, I think, is a critical part of that. Having, Andy Osmond and Phyllis Schneck in our leadership team, General Greg Tuhill, Danny Toler, all folks who really get the technology here, who are not just policymakers, but are PhDs in computer science, so that folks who are coming in with that kind of technical skill, they're not likely to be many of them PhDs, but they are going to be very technically savvy. They want to know that they're going to be part of a team and working for folks who understand that technology and the value of what they're doing. And I think, again, making sure they have a very clear, strong sense of mission is a big part of it. But it's something we're mindful of. It's one of the reasons we opened an office in Silicon Valley, is that we want to be exploring opportunities to bring people into the pipeline without having necessarily to bring them to Washington.
Let's talk about threats vis-a-vis the two major areas that you've talked about. When you look around the U.S. federal government at the .gov network right now, what scares you? What's the stuff that you say we still have just a huge amount of work to do?
So we, in the wake of OPM, you know, we had the president directed a 30-day sprint and then a longer-term effort, a central piece of which was identifying high-value assets. So undertaking the first step in that risk management process, figuring out where a disruption would have the most significant consequences in government terms, for example, to your mission essential functions, or where we have large stores of personal information that we have a responsibility to protect. Figure out where are your highest value assets. And then we have been undertaking, so we did that. We had an initial list of assets that was put together very quickly to go and look and see how we were doing on protecting that and where can we bolster the security of those assets. And then we had a longer term process to create a more in-depth and longer list. And we are at DHS working our way through each of those high value assets to assess their vulnerabilities and make recommendations for providing greater security. So that is the list of the places where at this point we believe there could be the most significant consequences from a cyber attack, and those are the ones we're focusing our effort on.
And are there agencies that you look at and you say in the last few years since you've been here, these agencies have done sort of particularly strong work in bringing themselves up to speed in a cybersecurity sense? I mean, are there areas that you look at and sort of in the unclassified sector and sort of reflect with particular satisfaction on what the government has managed to do?
Yes.
Would you like to tell us about them?
No. We work on a voluntary basis with folks. Now, Congress has mandated some of this stuff for the .gov that, you know, departments and agencies have to sign up for Einstein, for example. But really, particularly the intrusion response, the response activities, it's very important to us that we are seen as trusted people who you can call in and you can be open about your vulnerabilities and the issues that you're wrestling with and get some real top-notch guidance and help and not worry that we're going to be then going on a podcast and talking about you. So as soon as I start talking about the departments and agencies that are doing particularly well, it's going to beg the question about the departments and agencies that are still struggling.
Well, let's talk about that.
Right, and And I don't, you know, there's a FISMA scorecard that comes out every year. I don't know what, I actually don't know whether that's made public. But again, it's not our role. We don't view it as our role to go out in public and talk about who's doing well and who's not.
And now, let's talk instead about who's doing bad. Not among the agencies, but when you look around and you see, you know, who's in non-classified U.S. systems, who's attacking us, what are we worried about here?
So we're worried really about a couple of things. One, you know, and you understand, there's a range of cyber activities from kind of spy versus spy, nation-state espionage, which we worry about, as we've always worried about, from a counterintelligence perspective. And it runs the gamut from, and that is, you know, we worry increasingly that that might involve collection of information about individuals for intelligence purposes, right? All the way to the potential for destructive malicious activity, particularly with regard to critical infrastructure that might be privately owned or government-owned infrastructure, and certainly private critical infrastructure that government relies upon. So we worry about the gamut. The actors that we are concerned about, I think, are pretty well known. We have taken, I think, you know, we traditionally have taken some comfort in understanding that what we really want to be worried about is a conjunction of capability and destructive intent, destructive capability and destructive intent. And generally speaking, we have seen that those with the most destructive intent have the least capability. Those with the greatest capability tend to have the least destructive intent. But we're very mindful that if you think about this as a graph, that line, in terms of people with destructive intent, is moving greater and greater capabilities, right? So the capabilities are becoming more and more ubiquitous. That's worrisome. People with sophisticated capability, including destructive capability, who today may not have destructive intent, the events in the world could change that in a heartbeat, and that line suddenly flips up, and you've got that conjunction of intent and capability. So that's what I worry about the most, is that this is a very dynamic environment, and the things we sort of take some comfort in today could change very quickly and are changing. So we have to be a step ahead of it.
And how is that different when you think about the non-governmental sector that you're also responsible for? I mean, obviously, when you're talking about critical infrastructure, it's the same analysis. But a huge amount of the day-to-day cybersecurity problem is a problem of intellectual property theft and data theft that really doesn't have profound security implications. It just has, you know, profound economic growth implications. You're just removing a certain sector of wealth from the society and moving it somewhere else. And so when you protecting that kind of economic health is a fundamentally different mission from protecting, you know, critical infrastructure on which essential government functions rely. And how does that analysis change when you're talking about the sort of death by a million paper cuts of image of cybersecurity that we're also dealing with?
Right, and it's a good point, Ben, and it is a particular challenge. So we really focus and prioritize our efforts first and foremost on critical infrastructure and those things, the disruption of which would have a debilitating impact on national security, economic security, or public health and safety. But we're very mindful that those critical infrastructure assets, systems, and networks live in an ecosystem. And so we've seen that the HVAC vendor can be a vector for an attack on commercial facilities, for example, on a critical infrastructure sector. So we have to be mindful of all of it. And there is, as you say, the broader economic aggregate impact of the theft of intellectual property. With regard to that latter, that's one of the reasons that we worked very hard as part of an interagency team And the president was able last September to announce an agreement with President Xi of China to accept the peacetime norm that countries should not steal sensitive business information from each other to provide competitive advantage to companies in their own country. And there are a lot of skeptics about this, whether China's going to live up to this, but we think it was really an important step forward for China to make that public statement, because it is one they had not necessarily made before. And I think it's an important step forward in something the government can do to help companies protect themselves. Intellectual property theft ultimately has to be the first primary actor has to be the company. They have to figure out what it is that they value the most and do that risk management calculus and what is it worth to them to pay to try to protect that information. But government can also help create an environment in which the threat is reduced.
So about that China statement, we have had from the intelligence community somewhat differing accounts so far of what the degree of observed diminution or non-diminution of Chinese activity has been. Do you have an opinion about that? I mean, when you look out and you say, how active has this, theft of intellectual property for purposes of commercial gain been in the year now or 8 months since that agreement? Does the picture look essentially similar to you or essentially different?
So we're watching carefully, and we're mindful that in a big bureaucracy, it's a little bit like turning an aircraft carrier, and so, it might take some time. But we are watching it very carefully and are on the alert to see whether, in fact, China is living up to its commitment.
So when you look at DHS 10 years from now, it's gone over the last 13 years from zero to where you are now. How is it different 10 years from now than it is now in terms of what its day-to-day function is? Is it fully developed at this point, or is it still in a sort of, I don't mean this in a diminutive sense, but still in a sort of adolescence in terms of its maturity in cybersecurity? What does its adulthood look like?
When I first came into NPPD, NPPD is even newer than the department. It was established, created in 2008. And so I used to describe it as kind of a tweener.
Then I don't feel so bad.
Right, that it was, and this is not specific to its cyber mission by any means, but that, there was still a lot of maturing to do in terms of developing standard operating procedures and some of those kinds of basic things. But it was already so far along that you could really see the wonderful adult that it was becoming. And I do think that's true. And each day, that you see more and more reflections of that growing maturity. So where our cyber mission will be in 10 years is anybody's guess. Tom Donilon's commission, the cybersecurity commission that the president put in place, was asked to look 10 years out, and they've acknowledged that in such a dynamic environment, it's really hard to look that far out. It's really hard to tell, but I am very optimistic, particularly, again, given the consolidation of authorities and capabilities and the talent that's coming increasingly to DHS, that we will be meeting whatever the challenge is that we face at that time. I do think that you see in the president's CNAP, the Cyber National Action Plan, a growing sense that we need to do more for departments and agencies and providing them with additional help and assistance. And I think we are going to move more in that direction. ultimately, departments and agencies have to make those risk management decisions. So I think their CIOs will continue to be really in the driver's seat. But I think more and more we're realizing that we've got to provide more baseline assistance for departments and agencies. I think we'll get more and more toward in that direction. But 10 years is a very long time. I hope we'll have made significant progress in the dot-com world. I will say that since I've been at DHS, we've spent a great deal of time and effort on the .gov. And we've spent a lot of time on .com, but I think there's so much more we can do there.
And what's the big missing piece? I mean, when you say there's so much more we can do in the .com world, what has not been done from a DHS point of view? I mean, I know there's a million things that individual companies should do that they haven't done yet, but what's the institutional momentum that DHS hasn't done that you would want to see it do?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is one we've just stood up, and that is the automated information sharing. And so this is something that we've been working on for a couple of years, and then Congress gave us a boost in the Cybersecurity Act by providing this newly incentivized program for the private sector to share cyber threat indicator information with DHS, with the NCIC, and then we have the responsibility to take those indicators and get them out in real time across the federal government, but also back out to private sector participants in this automated information sharing. It's machine to machine and allows us finally to begin to move with the speed that our adversaries move. What was interesting about that is that they also they provided liability protection for the sharing of that information. That's the incentive there for the private sector to share with government. But they also provided that liability protection for private sector sharing with private sector. And so what we hope to see develop, what needs to develop, is that network of networks. And it's not all just coming into the federal government, but it's also all of these networks of private sector participants, so that we can get to the point where an adversary who tries to penetrate a system is detected, that information is sent throughout that network of networks to everybody, every node gets that information immediately. And where today the adversary can reuse the same infrastructure, the same signatures over and over, the same malware over and over, sometimes for years, this would allow us to stop that adversary after the first sign of detection. And that would be a huge step forward.
And so what's stopping that? At this point, I mean, the system is up and running. Are companies using it?
So we've had companies, a lot of companies have expressed interest. We have companies, a few companies who've actually gone through the process to put the technology, the infrastructure in place to be able to receive this structured threat indicator information. And we've got a number more in the pipeline. We're starting small. We want to make sure that we've tested and got the bugs, any bugs that might be in the system, and that we've got it operating smoothly. So we haven't gone out in a big way to try to drum up a lot of business yet, but we will do that and spread the word. So I think part of it is that we haven't, again, a lot of people aren't aware of this, so we'll need to work on that. There's also still, I think, some educating to be done and a reluctance. You know, my biggest laugh line when I speak, of course, I talk about all the resources we bring to bear to help folks in cybersecurity, and I say, we really are. We're from the government, and we're here to help you. This crowd is all a government crowd, so no one's laughing. But normally, that's a big laugh line. And so it's an indication of the work we have to do to continue to build that trust.
So over what time frame should we expect to see what with the information sharing system? I mean, you know, is at what point do we look at it and expect that the average vulnerability that's detected is instantly entered into the system and, you know, sprayed all over the United States to everybody who can then use it? When is that going to be the reality, or should we, over what time should we expect to see what?
Right. I think that will take some time, and again, it will not just be a result of of the work that we're doing, but it will also be because of what's happening in the private sector among cybersecurity providers, for example. You see, there are at least a couple of different groupings of companies that have decided not to compete on the basis of the information that they and only they hold with respect to cyber threat indicators, but instead to pool their information with their competitors and to compete with on the basis of what they can do with that information, on the basis of the sophistication of their data analytics, on the basis of the tools that can make use of that information quickly. So they will also play a key role, and they're growing all the time, more companies coming on board to share that cyber threat indicator information. So sharing the information, having the technology to share the information, that needs to happen. But then we also need to have companies have in place the intrusion prevention systems to respond with the same speed, right? So that getting that information is not enough. You also then have to have the capability to use that information to stop that malicious activity. But again, the technologies are out there. This is not a huge technological challenge. It's an education and awareness and getting buy-in
and
challenge.
And a willingness to use the systems challenge.
Right.
So we have time for some questions from the audience. If you want to ask a question, there are microphones in the corner.
I'm Steve Bunnell. I'm the general counsel at DHS. Suzanne, I wanted to ask you if there was anything you could share with the group about DHS's role, and I guess more broadly the federal government's role, in not in perpetrating the incident in the Ukraine, but in terms of helping to understand what happened over there, and if there are any lessons from what happened in the Ukraine that you could share with this group.
Steve, thank you for the question, and I promise I didn't plant it, but I'm really pleased to be asked it, because this is a story that we are very anxious to tell, and we have actually mounted a campaign all across the country, in addition to a number of webinars, to try to sound the alarm, frankly, about the incident in Ukraine. So, as many of you know, last December, a couple days before Christmas, in the dead of winter, there was the first cyber attack, destructive attack on critical infrastructure upon which civilian populations depend. It was an attack on the electric grid in Ukraine. It brought down the power for 250,000 people. We were invited by Ukraine to come over as part of an interagency team to help them, again, to figure out what had happened here, to make sure that the bad actors were off their system, and to help them think about how to rebuild more securely. The bad news, obviously, is that, you know, we saw this first destructive attack, and it had a pretty significant impact. The good news is it was not a particularly sophisticated attack, and we know how to prevent what happened in Ukraine. So we put out an alert from our computer emergency readiness team out of our operations center that told people on an unclassified document, here's what happened in Ukraine, and here's how you can prevent it from happening to you. Here are the mitigation measures. And we posted that. We get that out to all the folks who follow our alerts. But as I say, that wasn't enough, because the systems that they attacked are systems used not just by the electric industry, but by industries in all sectors, all across the country. These are basic industrial control systems. And so we did. We took a team that went city to city across the country to invite critical infrastructure owners and operators, private sector folks in, to hear about what happened there and how to prevent it from happening to them.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name's Nick Channon. I'm an intern at the FCC. I was wondering if you could talk to what extent DHS has been engaging with industry in terms of securing the Internet of Things as that becomes an increasingly large surface against which attacks could be launched.
Yeah, we are working with industry on this and some sectors of particular concern, but more broadly as well. And so we're looking at the clearly 50 billion devices is the estimate, one estimate connected to the internet by the year 2020. I mean, that's a huge number of devices. And I am concerned that we're building now this Internet of Things potentially without being mindful of cybersecurity. So I went to the Consumer Electronics Show in January, and they had all these wonderful networked consumer items that they were touting, and I was very mindful of the potential cyber risks. When I went to the RSA conference, the big cybersecurity conference, a few months later, they also had a beautiful home with all of the networked items, the thermostat, the teapot, the doorbell, etc. But they were explaining the potential cyber vulnerabilities that might be introduced there. We are working to bring those communities together. I think we need to begin to think about the Internet of Things not just as a massive attack surface, but potentially as an opportunity. We didn't build the Internet with security in mind, but we're much smarter now. We're building a new Internet, an Internet of Things, that in some ways dwarfs the original Internet. And if we build it the right way, perhaps it can help us solve our broader Internet cybersecurity challenge.
But let me just push you on that, because what you just said, meaning to be encouraging, actually seems to me rather depressing, which is that the people who are actually building things are, you go to their conference and you say, oh God, this is really bad from a cybersecurity point of view. And it's only when you go to a conference that's actually about security do you say, wow, people are really thinking about security. And I wonder, as long as RSA is a separate conference that all the security people go to, and then the people who do anything other than security don't integrate the RSA discussions into the discussions that they're having, we're kind of in bad shape, right?
So let me be clear. At the Consumer Electronics Show, there were a number of programs about cybersecurity. So I do not mean, and I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to clarify, I do not mean to suggest that they are unmindful of cybersecurity. They're generally innovators and entrepreneurs who are developing neat things for the consumers that are taking full advantage of this networked world, which is what we want. They're not typically, first and foremost, cybersecurity experts. It doesn't mean they're unmindful of the cybersecurity challenges. And so, again, I think they are looking for help. They are looking for solutions. They are looking for ways forward. They're often operating at the margins. And so they, you know, and they're very competitive in terms of price. And so I think they present a unique challenge, but also an opportunity for those cybersecurity providers to come in and help them to anticipate the ways in which, you know, having good cybersecurity can provide them with competitive advantage. That only works if we have educated consumers who are asking those questions as well.
So we are basically out of time. We have one more question back there, and we'll make this the last one.
Thank you. My name is Eric Mampra. I'm a summer legal intern with the Legal Counsel Division of Office of General Counsel at DHS. One of the major mission areas of DHS is resiliency in the wake of man-made and natural disasters. And that's an area in which DHS has been quite successful in recent history, although it can be quite hard to measure at times. But what does resiliency look like in terms of cybersecurity? So in terms of the day after an attack, not just preventing it, but after it occurs, what does it look like, and how can DHS improve and encourage resiliency in this area in the future?
Yep, great question. Glad you're spending some time at DHS. We're lucky to have you. Because it is critically important. And so when I describe our mission at NPPD, at the National Protection Programs Directorate, it is to strengthen the security and resilience of the nation's critical infrastructure. And that includes the .gov infrastructure, both physical and cyber. And so when we talk about resilience, we're talking about, I remember in, I think it was 2010, DOD strategy for the first time talked about operating in a degraded environment in cyber. Right? It implicit is the understanding and the recognition that the best layered defense in the world is still not going to give you 100% protection against malicious cyber activity. So you have to be able to detect that very quickly. You have to be able to respond to that, and you have to be able to recover quickly. And I think resilience in the context of cybersecurity is one of those areas where you've got to bring your physical experts to the table. It's one of the reasons that I'm so concerned that we not find ourselves operating in a cyber stovepipe with physical expertise over here on this side of the room and cyber is over here, as if our only cyber ninjas and our network experts can solve our cybersecurity challenge. Sometimes the most effective mitigation from a cyber attack that might have significant consequences will be physical, will be like putting in a hand crank, right? Having some physical redundancy. Just like in Ukraine, they didn't bring the power back on because the cyber experts fixed the industrial control systems and the network system. They did it because they got engineers in trucks who drove out to where the breakers had been remotely switched, and by hand they manually flipped them back in place. Resilience is one of the key places where we have to bring our physical experts and our cyber experts together to understand consequences and ways in which we can mitigate them.
On that note, we are going to call it a day. Thank you very much, Suzanne, for joining us and speaking to us.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music, as ever, is performed by the Right Honorable Sophia Yan, who became the official Lawfare pianist long before she became a famed CNN journalist. You need to do your part to spread the word about the Lawfare podcast. Tweet it, share it, talk about it incessantly at dinner parties. Be annoying, and thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.